decided to pick up the same story, you get to choose which version you like best, which stage in history you want to repeat or do over or make new. I apologize for the title, but it's all the ideas. One is incorporating civil rights principles, not necessarily civil rights law. That's so far hung up, as Joel has described. But civil rights principles are fairly clear in case law. I'm a sociologist. You get to choose ideal types, you know, which case law you like. It's different when the legal system runs on precedent. So that's why we're all here together, you see, talking about the same theme, but from our different perspectives. I'm talking about strategies for incorporating civil rights principles into public health regulations. We have regulations right now, licensing, quality assurance, accreditation, and conditions of participation. Those levers of accountability don't incorporate civil rights principles, but they could. That's why I think we have an opportunity to make a system more publicly accountable, both to reduce health disparities and to strengthen the way the healthcare delivery system functions at the community level so that it's more efficient, effective, and equitable. This cartoon captures the healthcare system that exists right now. A business manager masquerading as a doctor is providing a clinical service to who he thinks is a patient, but of course the patient doesn't know his own rights. He depends on the lawyer. So actually, I'm not a doctor, the healthcare administrator admits, but the patient says, that's okay, I'm not a patient, I'm his attorney. That's the reality. All right, assumption number one. We have a lack of systemness at the community level. The healthcare system is highly fragmented. The best illustrations of this, I think, are evident in some of the Commonwealth Fund scorecard healthcare performance measures. I'll show you a couple of them. This is people went to the ER for a condition that could have been treated by a regular doctor. This is a survey among sicker adults in various countries. On the left, you see the U.S., 26% of patients using the ER inappropriately, all the way down to only 6% in Germany. And then if you want to see it on the right, in the U.S., by race and ethnicity, whites 23%, blacks 41%. Also, those with higher incomes, less likely to use the ER inappropriately, not a surprise, and those who are insured are less likely to use it than those who are uninsured. Another example, physicians' use of electronic medical records, the U.S. compared to other countries. We're down there at 17% in 2001. Could you move the screen over? Anyway, Sweden up there with 98%. All right, receipt of recommended preventive care for older adults by race and ethnicity, also by income and insurance status. And again, you can see that no surprises here. Preventive services are the ones where there's evidence-based medicine that it pays to have these, that it makes a difference to get these services. And as you can tell, the racial and ethnic minorities are less likely to get them, those with lower incomes less likely to get them, those who are not insured full-time less likely to get them. Assumption number two, racial and ethnic minorities are an important litmus test for the impact of our market-driven healthcare system, because they are disproportionately uninsured, disproportionately low income, and have a higher incidence of chronic health conditions. Here's another cartoon which, in a sense, raises the question of what could race and ethnicity and language groups reveal about our system? This cartoon says, and by the way, it shows a black doctor entering a waiting room to tell the expectant father some information about his wife's pregnancy, and the black doctor says, "It's a baby, but federal regulations prohibit our mentioning its race, age, or gender." Now, this of course doesn't happen. This is make-believe. But the other people's presentations aren't make-believe, and a lot of things the government could be doing in terms of giving us information about race and ethnicity are not being used. And that's the reason I chose that slide. Health disparities are an important measure of inequalities in income, wealth, and power, both in the healthcare system and in the larger societies. I think the previous presentation makes that case very well. And assumption number four, healthcare reform has tended to focus on access issues requiring new funds to meet unmet needs, and that quality issues would be addressed through additional money for bonuses, you see, to create financial incentives in a competitive marketplace. Meanwhile, we keep saying we have enough money in the healthcare system, and it isn't being allocated in an appropriate way. This is where I feel the civil rights principles come into play. Healthcare disparities are a key to public accountability in a fragmented healthcare marketplace. Health disparities invite civil rights principles of non-discrimination. Health disparities expose social determinants of health. Yes, minorities have poorer health, not just because the healthcare system isn't functioning well, so this gives us an opportunity to focus on what are those social determinants of health, poverty, poor education, environmental risks, the things that make a huge difference. And health disparities provide a basis for overcoming the fragmentation in healthcare delivery at the community level. Joel has a good discussion on the question of intentional discrimination and disparate impact. I'll just mention that no one has ever questioned the government, the federal government's ability, jurisdiction over dealing with non-discrimination for disparate impact. The courts, the federal court, Supreme Court, says you just can't make them do it. So when advocates tried to require, under the Clinton administration, the Healthcare Financing Administration to require the collection of race and ethnicity data in the Madison Hughes versus Shalala, the Clinton administration, after losing on universal health care, fought the class action suit about requiring even the required collection of this information. I don't understand it. But we have, as our previous two speakers have talked about, voluntary enforcement, OCR decoupled from healthcare financing, the courts blocking the right to sue against government agency or against private business, and the courts basically being very reluctant to challenge business necessity defenses. In other words, when the hospitals choose to move out of the inner city when the minorities become the majority and go to the white suburbs, as a business decision, the courts did not say, hey, that's creating disparate impact. You can't do that with federal money. When there is 60% of the healthcare expenditures publicly funded in this country, more public money in healthcare in the United States than in any country with universal healthcare on a per capita basis. Unbelievable. So ADA comes along in 1990, and interestingly enough, people with disabilities were not in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, so they wanted also to be not discriminated against, and so they went, they got included in 1973, in the Rehab Act of 1973, but that only applied to federally funded programs. And recognizing that most people have private health insurance, they said, we want coverage. We want to be not discriminated against anywhere in the healthcare marketplace. Congress did a unique thing. They said, for people with disabilities, we will extend the non-discrimination principles of Title VI to people with disabilities. So there are three very interesting bells and whistles in the ADA that are not in Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. One of them is the concept of reasonable accommodation. That means what changes have to be made to the delivery system to acquire, to achieve equal access. Equal benefits, equal access. Very interesting theoretical question, and we have 15 years of judicial experience with it. That concept of reasonable accommodation makes a whole lot of sense in the racial and ethnic minority community, but it didn't occur to people in 1964. Discrimination at that time, we thought, was not allowing minorities into the healthcare system. If you just stop not allowing them in, then there's no discrimination. But in fact, that's not the case at all. And so those are the unmet challenges that we still have. Another concept in this ADA is the extension of this concept of public accommodation. All businesses, public or private, are public accommodations. This Part B exclusion of doctors receiving Medicare dollars that Joel mentioned doesn't exist under the ADA. Doctors are public accommodations when they're serving people with disabilities. That same doctor serving a racial or ethnic minority person is not a public accommodation. This is our legal system. Anyway, the other concept that's very interesting and not used very effectively is program accessibility. That means looking at the system as a whole, as opposed to requiring every component of the system to be 100% accessible. So, for example, in the ADA, each doctor is supposed to be 100% accessible, no matter who comes to him. But does that really make sense for the healthcare system to require every doctor to be 100% accessible, or should there be a focus on healthcare delivery as a program within a geographical area that provides services to meet everybody's needs, but in ways that are equal? Maybe this is another form of separate but equal, but I don't think it's separate. We're talking really about quality assurance applied to healthcare delivery as a system, and I think that should be a goal. It could have evolved out of the Hill-Burton Act, but didn't. All right, non-discrimination principles under the ADA, what does it mean? Here's 10 examples. Self-determination. Who's the best judge of what services a person with a disability needs in order to get equal treatment? Well, actually, under the ADA, the doctor gets to decide. But at least he's encouraged to ask the person with a disability, what do you think you need in order to have equal treatment, whether it's a sign language interpreter or a certain kind of format in communication, or physical barriers to be removed, or more interestingly, methods of administration that need to be modified in order to ensure equal access. We can get back into that later. No one-size-fits-all solution. Not every person with a disability needs a sign language interpreter. In fact, not every deaf person needs a sign language interpreter. So that's not the one-size-fits-all solution we're looking for. But we need an equal opportunity for all persons with disabilities in relation to people without disabilities. That's the reference group. Inclusion in planning, in training, in evaluation. Integration. We want the healthcare system to serve everybody, and through the most efficient and effective settings, physical access barriers need to be removed, equal access to all of the services, effective communication, program modifications are necessary, and not charging the protected group for equal access. reasonable accommodation you can't charge for. It's built into the cost of production of doing business for the individual provider. But that is itself a problem. If a deaf patient goes to a certain doctor, only that doctor has the responsibility of contributing to the sign language interpreter. It's the most controversial issue in the application of the ADA to healthcare delivery. We don't have mechanisms for spreading those reasonable accommodation costs throughout the community. I think that's the kind of problem we need to raise. I won't describe this, but this is a Gary Larson cartoon of inconvenience stores. You can see the shelves are kind of high for the guy at the bottom there. And if I had a long time, I would show you how the ADA applies to inconvenience stores. But instead, I'll talk a little more about ADA case law in regard to healthcare. Oregon Medicaid prioritization process. That was our first successful application of the ADA. And I actually organized that. And we got the government to say, you can't use methods of administration that discriminate against people with disabilities. Very interesting precedent. Before then, the expectation was that the ADA, maybe it just applies to the width of the door of the insurance company that you buy your insurance from. This basically was a wake-up call that it means something else. Risk-adjusted utilization review, Zamora case in Medicare managed care. Here's a doctor who gets fired for not meeting the utilization review criteria of the managed care plan. And he says, hey, did you take into account the fact that most of my patients have disabilities? And so the utilization review criteria needs to be risk adjusted. They said, no, we didn't take that into account. That's a method of administration. But that's exactly the point. He was covered by the ADA, not because he had a disability, but because he was associated with people with disabilities. He was their doctor. Very interesting precedent. We won that one. Hospital closing. David just showed you or mentioned that the hospital flights out of the inner cities, the courts were not very helpful in stopping. At best, they would negotiate deals where maybe a bus would be delivered, you know, would take people to the new location in the white suburbs. But in Los Angeles, when the Los Angeles government wanted to close down a premier medical rehab center for people with spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury, the ADA was used to challenge that decision and saying, there's no replacement for this service if you take it away. It would be a violation of equal access. And so the court said the county government could not do that. When a dentist said to a woman with HIV, I don't want to serve you in my office, you see, she sued under the ADA and won because there are ways of dealing with infection from HIV, and this is not a question of the doctor's choice. There are public health principles that APHA supported and that the American Dental Association supported, and the courts gave credence to that. And there was an accessibility standards issue, durable medical equipment in Kaiser Permanente in California. When patients in wheelchairs couldn't get physical exams because the doctor's office was not accessible, we challenged that under civil rights law, state civil rights law, and we won. Again, an important precedent. The question is, how do you take these precedents and institutionalize them? And my last issue here, example, is sign language interpreters. Very expensive service. You got to pay for it each time the sign language interpreter is there. This particular case in 1994 was one where a deaf patient said, I don't just want a sign language interpreter. I want a bilingual mental health counselor who knows how to do sign language. We won that one. I know times change, but anyway, limitations of applying civil rights laws. One of them is it doesn't take effect, you see, unless you sue. Well, a lot of patients don't want to sue the doctors that they're dependent on. Doesn't work. A lot of doctors don't know their responsibilities under these laws, not well informed. The court's reluctant to challenge business necessity defenses. The courts have blocked the right to sue in disparate impact cases, as Joel has pointed out. We have not really operationalized what Title VI means in regulation. That is an open challenge for all of us. To me, it's as important as talking about expanding access to the uninsured if we really want to make a publicly accountable healthcare system. Racial and ethnic data not required to be collected in a standardized way to enforce Title VI. That's that case that I mentioned, the Shalala resisting. Anyway, so the solution is we know what non-discrimination means. Let's figure out how to apply it to the levers of accountability that we already have in the healthcare system. Licensing. For example, Massachusetts. They have a breast cancer screening clinic that's licensed by the state. And in the licensing requirements is they have to be ADA accessible. They have to have ADA. They have to have accessible equipment. They have to have staff that know how to use it, so that when a woman in a wheelchair gets a mammography, she has as much confidence in it as a woman without a wheelchair getting that mammography. Massachusetts, as part of its universal healthcare initiative, has also required the collection by hospitals of race and ethnicity data. Accreditation standards right now from JCO don't require that of all hospitals around the country. Quality assurance. Crucial issue, totally underdeveloped. How can we make sure that the services that people are actually getting are comparable? And you could be looking at waiting times, you could be looking at outcome measures. There are lots of issues around that. Accreditation standards. We have cultural and linguistic appropriate services. Nicely spelled out, 14 services, principles that the Office for Minority Health has recommended. These are recommendations. These are not mandates. The only mandate part here is the one related to language access standards, which are enforced in a hospital setting, not in doctor's offices, where people with disabilities do have that kind of protection, although not always adequately reinforced. I could talk about any one of these things at great length, including the community needs assessment. We need that kind of thing so that the services that are provided are judged to be the most efficient, effective, and equitable, the kind of planning issues that David mentioned. And lastly, we have the conditions of participation. Even in the Hill-Burton Act, there was the expectation that there would be a certificate of need and that there would be community benefits that the hospitals would be required to provide as a result of getting Hill-Burton money. But the government never said at the federal level what those community benefits had to be. And that is the kind of challenges that we have to mobilize people, to get these laws operationalized. I think there are roles for local health departments, and we'll hear from Adewale in a minute on how he's dealing with various issues here. There are state issues and certificate of need issues. I don't really want to take more time there, but let me give you a little bit of humor on this. This was probably designed to discredit HMOs. You see a man going through an airport x-ray machine, and the caption says, "It's a little deal my HMO worked out with the airport to cut down on costs." But in fact, there may be ways of making more complementary, better examples than this, of course. Now, here's an interesting thing. You probably haven't seen that even at an APHA conference. But there are health disparities issues related that we could be collecting information on disparities, the way the Healthy People 2010. This was an IOM report on consequences of uninsurance, and they basically said it's unfair to the providers. because the providers are losing the market, you see, when the uninsured are not getting care. That's been followed up in an interesting article in Health Affairs by Mark Pauly and Pagan, who point out that it also hurts other patients too, and not just the uninsured patients, but the insured patients. And he has an interesting article on that in the current issue. Here's a really nice slide. I think this shows in a very clear way from the Medical Legal Partnership for Children in Massachusetts how you can approach the health disparities issues at the front end around the increased risks, or you know, from poverty, housing, environmental exposures, poor food, all those social determinants. You could also reduce the access barriers in the healthcare delivery system. Or you can use the advocacy at the same time to intervene at the healthcare delivery system to improve healthcare. I'm not going to take the time right now, but Title VI, Joel alluded to this, has been operationalized in education. You know that all schools have to report on testing scores by race. We don't do that in healthcare. Why not? I'm not saying everything about No Child Left Behind is good, but they're at least exposing problems. Environmental justice, really interesting way of getting Title VI into the environmental regulation area. President Clinton did that through an executive order, and now it's being deflected, but EPA is trying to figure out how are they supposed to collect information on disproportionately high adverse environmental risks. You saw even in the cultural diversity FCC regulations on consolidation of the news media. There are issues here to maximize local programming. These issues are comparable in different sectors of society. Healthcare is not unique, except for the fact that we all have healthcare needs, and it's mostly publicly funded. Housing, mortgages, Joel alluded to, and employment as well. The government collects information on race and ethnicity from every employer. That doesn't mean that they decide based on that collection that discrimination is taking place, but they mark they see trends, and then they can drill down. All right, summary. Title VI is the strongest part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It's based on federal spending power, and as David mentioned, if the government is paying for something, they can demand how it gets used, and non-discrimination is the standard. The other concept here, 60% healthcare expenditures are public dollars. All the hospitals receive Medicare dollars. Even 85% of physicians receive some Medicaid payments. And if you receive any federal dollars, you're expected to apply non-discrimination to all of your patients, not just the ones you're getting federal dollars for. So the infrastructure is lacking, but the authority is already there. The acid test for healthcare, for civil rights, is not how to empower individual patients to force a particular provider to eliminate barriers to equal access for minorities, but how to distribute all healthcare resources within a geographical area in the most efficient, effective, and equitable way. That is a principle of universal design. I propose it as something we ought to take seriously. And then lastly, we need to think about healthcare as a system, overcoming fragmentation, generating savings in the healthcare system that can be captured and redirected to those social determinants of health, and creating incentives for reducing inequalities in all sectors of society. In other words, civil rights as a countervailing influence on market forces. Thank you.